One hardly needs to explain who Richard Dawkins is. He's certainly the world's best-known biologist, and he's famous for his abrasive confrontations with anybody who happens to promote the concept of creationism. His collisions with fundamental Christians who believe it's all God's work are legendary. His books sell in their millions. His latest book is specifically about the evidence for evolution. But having written so extensively about the subject for so long, why, I asked him, was this book necessary now?
With all my books, the main objective is to excite and interest and enthrall. And this was no exception. This particular one's about the evidence for evolution, and so it has that slant. It's supposed to show how we know that evolution is a fact, whereas some of my earlier books took that for granted and dealt with other things.
You feel a need, clearly, to spell out what you regard as the proof in the face of what is a continuing scepticism about the proof. Why does that scepticism exist?
I wouldn't give that top priority. Proof is a strong word. It's something that, strictly speaking, perhaps only mathematicians should talk about proof, but strong evidence anyway. Why is there a need for it? Well, it is true that Gallup polls in America have suggested that there's a rather large number of people who actually don't accept evolution as a fact and who even think that the world is only about 10,000 years old or less, which is an astonishing error. So if you want to couch it as a need, I suppose that's it. But I'd rather prefer to come back to saying that it's just a very exciting and interesting story in its own right.
Let's deal with that. You laid out some rather remarkable statistics in your book, the polls that have been taken, and indeed in the UK. But the United States is the kind of poster for the creationist belief, for reasons which we needn't go into here and most people will probably understand. I was astonished when I read something over 40% of those actually believe that the world was created something like 10,000 years ago. Bang, like that.
Yes.
And they hold to that belief in spite of the growing amount of evidence. I mean, are we dealing essentially with two camps here which are unable to get to grips with each other?
Well, I think we are. I think that the United States is rather a polarised society now. It is odd, though, isn't it, the way that most of those people would be perfectly capable of handling a logical argument. They will proceed logically and methodically when doing something ordinary in everyday life, like fixing the car or mending a tap washer or something like that. So it's not that they're completely loopy in all other respects, but just this one thing about evolution and reason and logic and respect for evidence just suddenly leaves them.
Yeah. I'll come back to that in due course. But first of all, the accidental nature of evolution is one of its characteristics. And yet you say this whole thing is not about chance. What is the difference?
Well, it isn't accidental. I think that's probably one of the misconceptions that has led people to those errors. Mutation is accidental, mutation being the production of the genetic variation which natural selection then works upon. But natural selection chooses the best, chooses the fastest runner, the keenest eyes, the keenest ears, the sharpest teeth. So that's very much not accidental. That's going for the ones that are best at surviving and best at reproducing.
Yes. Well, so therefore chance plays no part in any of this.
Chance plays a part in the production of the original genetic variation that natural selection then works upon.
Yeah.
Chance also plays a role in which of various possible solutions to the problem get through. So there is a chance element to it, but it's very misleading to say that it's all chance. If you say it's all chance, then people will quite rightly say, well, in that case, I don't believe it, because if you look at the beauty of a flying albatross, say, or a burrowing mole, the elegance of it, you immediately know that that is not the product of chance. That's the product of either design, which is actually no kind of explanation, or, and this is the true explanation, natural selection.
If you look back over the last century or so, and you actually ask this question in your latest book, The Greatest Show on Earth, Why did it take so long for a Darwin to arrive on the scene?
Interesting question, isn't it? Particularly when you contrast it with the fact that Newton was two centuries earlier, and as I always thought that what Newton achieved required far more difficult brain work than what Darwin achieved, and yet humanity had to wait two more centuries before a Darwin came on the scene. I think it may be partly that it seems so commonsensical that, as I said before, an albatross's wing has got to be designed. It looks as though it's designed. It looks so kind of perfect that people of the intellect of Newton, great philosophers, didn't even bother to consider the possibility that it could have had a natural cause. I think that's possibly one reason why it took so long for a Darwin to come on the scene. Another reason is that because it's so slow, because rabbits remain rabbits remain rabbits for thousands of years, you need to live for millions of years before they'll turn into something else, people got used to the idea that there's a kind of essence of rabbit, that there's a sort of unchangeable yes. rabbitiness which will never turn into anything else. So that may also have been a barrier to the idea.
You talk about what you call the dead hand of Plato, essentialism, and I guess this is a large part of what
it was
about.
Yes, that's right, yes.
And that in effect, has put a brake on our being able to see the wonder of it all and the sheer longevity and scale of it.
Yes, that's right.
Has it moved from... There's a great deal of debate about whether evolution has moved from being a theory to what effectively is a theorem, something which in maths is more or less established.
Yes.
The facts, you say, are established beyond all question. What then, if anything, remains to be settled?
Oh, well, quite a lot of detail. It is a fact. It's now a fact beyond all reasonable doubt that evolution has happened. It's a fact that we are cousins of monkeys and cousins of dogs and more distant cousins of snails and octopuses and things. That's beyond doubt. But there are many details that are still doubted and still needing to be worked on. How much of evolution is chance and how much is not? Does evolution proceed gradually all the time or does it go in fits and starts? What actually is the tree of life? Which animals are closer to what? When I was an undergraduate, it would have been inconceivable that whales are close cousins of hippopotamuses. Not only that, they are whales spring right from within the major group of the even-toed ungulates, the cloven-hoofed animals. So it's not that they're kind of just related to the cloven-hoofed animals. They are more closely related to hippos than hippos are to any other cloven-hoofed animals. Well, that's an astonishing fact, which has come about through molecular genetics. And so there are probably lots more surprises of that kind waiting to be unearthed, surprises about details. But the broad fact that evolution has happened is beyond all doubt.
It's the little details and the absence of the kinds of connections over millennia that the doubters drive, or at least try to drive, a wedge into. And it's very difficult, I imagine, to try to explain that in a day or so to somebody who is genuinely doubting and who is driven by some other belief.
Well, that driven by some other belief is important. It's an odd idea when you come to think of it, that if you've got two kind of major ideas, Theory 1 and Theory 2, and Theory 2 has absolutely no evidence going for it whatever, Theory 1 has masses of evidence going for it, but Theory 1 encounters a slight disagreement. There's perhaps a slight disagreement between various proponents of Theory 1. So the sensible thing, obviously, is for those people to iron out their differences, look further at the evidence. But what these other people do is say, oh, well, Theory 2 must be right, simply because there's some minor disagreement of detail going on in Theory 1. Of course, by Theory 1, I mean evolution.
Yes. One sees a certain parallel in this between this and the climate change debate.
I think there is a parallel, yes.
Yeah. And it's the same instinct that's driving it?
Well,
and there's no religious
dimension. It's not religion in that case. No. I suspect it's economics. I mean, I think that there are powerful business interests who don't want to believe or don't want it to become generally known that climate change is potentially disastrous and man-made.
reading your books, I get the unmistakable impression that you've become utterly fed up with the so-called creationists, and that you've become rather grumpy about anyone who believes in God at all. Is that a fair assessment of it?
I don't like the word grumpy too much. I'd have thought, I mean, this book is actually not about God. The Great Show on Earth is really mostly not about God. My previous book, The God Delusion, was... I wouldn't have called it a grumpy book. I think it's actually rather a humorous book. Sarcastic, maybe, but I think in a humorous way.
A number of reviewers have fastened on the sarcasm occasionally and said, yes, he's really only just having another go at the creationist, and that's not very fair. Maybe that's not a very fair assessment.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. That will go on, I guess.
I guess, yes. I mean, the kind of thing I meant by sarcasm was in the God delusion, I was talking about the fact that Pope John Paul II believed that he'd been saved from assassination by Our Lady of Fatima. And I emphasised, why Our Lady of Fatima? I mean, how many Our Ladies are there? Yes. And then I said sarcastically, presumably Our Lady of Medjugorje, Our Lady of Knock, Our Lady of Garabandal, etc., were all busy on other errands at the time. I mean, that's an example of sarcasm, and a fairly good-natured sarcasm.
Yes. Well, as long as it remains good-natured, yeah. It's fine, I guess, for them. I'm interested in who exactly are the problem. I mean, is there a difference between the creationists, the literalists, those who interpret the Bible literally, and the majority who believe in God but who feel very uncomfortable about creationism?
Oh, yes, of course.
The other 60% probably in the United States.
Yes, that's correct. The so-called young earth creationists, the really bonkers ones who believe that the world is only 6,000 years old. Then there are many who call themselves religious who feel that God probably had something to do with it and maybe started it all off in the first place, that kind of thing. That would be, I suppose, the majority of respectable theologians. And then there are some who I suppose you'd call deists who don't really subscribe to the view of God as an interfering individual who listens to your prayers and forgives your sins, but just some kind of remote physicist or mathematician who set the laws of physics in motion in the first place and then did nothing more.
Isn't it true that religion itself, if you set aside the creationist obsession... or doctrine, or whatever one likes to call it, that religion itself is extremely valuable in a social context, that belief, a broad belief, brings solace, peace, comfort to many millions of people, and that some, I don't know how many of those people who hear about evolution and who get the message somehow that this is a challenge to God's place in the universe, are going to tilt the other way.
There could be something in that. I'm not sure I'd be quite as gung-ho as you would be about the consolation of religion. I think it cuts both ways. I mean, some people may get consolation from it. Other people may be terrified. I mean, a lot of people are terrified of going to hell, for example, which, yeah, if you don't have religion, you don't have to be terrified of. But even if it is consoling, it's important not to jump from that to assume that therefore it's got to be true. I mean, truth is quite a different idea. Either it's true or it's not, and to show that it's consoling doesn't mean that it's true. But then your point was that if people feel that their consolation is threatened, if they feel that evolution is going to threaten their faith and might take their consolation away, this might bias them against it. Yes. Again, that's a funny kind of logic. I mean, you could say something like, if a doctor tells you that you've got cancer, it's pretty disagreeable. You don't get much consolation from that. But you wouldn't go and believe somebody else, say a faith healer, who told you, oh, it's okay, you haven't got cancer after all, just because you want to believe it. I mean, what you want to believe is irrelevant to what is actually true.
Well, yes, but a lot of people do go to faith healers because they want to believe.
Well,
in some respects,
indeed,
they are healed,
right,
as a result,
yes,
of that.
Yes, well, that's their problem.
Yes. Is humanity's fascination with the mystical itself a product of evolution?
Well, it's quite a difficult question to ask what's the product of evolution, because very often the product of evolution is seen very indirectly. And so brains are a product of evolution, and mystical obsessions are a product of brains. And so certainly in that very indirect sense it is. You'd need to be a little bit stronger than that, I suppose, to answer your question positively and say that something about an inclination towards mysticism, a psychological inclination towards mysticism, does have some sort of biological survival value. That's possible. I'm not quite sure what that would be. I mean, maybe if we go back to the point about consolation, maybe consolation has survival value because you're less likely to suffer from stress-related illnesses like ulcers if you are consoled by some sort of mystical belief.
Do you accept the theory that Nicholas Wade came up in Spirit Level, that man's propensity for religion has an adaptive function?
Well, possibly. I mean, that's what I was kind of saying, that it may be that a psychological predisposition to which manifests itself as religion under the right cultural circumstances, that might have biological value. But, of course, once again, that doesn't make it true.
No. And I guess it doesn't make it true that the evolution of human behaviour has some biological origin.
Well, pretty clearly, many aspects of human behaviour does have biological origin. We are biological creatures. We are animals. So that our desire to copulate, our desire to eat, our desire to drink, etc., all sorts of desires of ours, do have a biological Darwinian origin.
To come back to the mystical, I mean, we've retained this desire to delve into the mystical or to be bewitched by the mystical, whichever way you like put it. It doesn't seem to have gone away, and yet human history suggests that it ought to.
Well, it depends what you mean by mystical. I think you can be intensely moved by a beautiful sunset or by the stars or by looking down a microscope at the complexity of life. You can be very moved by that. And that's awfully easy to give a label like mystical too. And it might be actually quite hard to distinguish the mental experiences of a religious mystic from somebody like Einstein, who was a scientist who was deeply moved by science and almost had a kind of mystical response to science, but never ever flirted with the supernatural.
In your address in Wellington, you made a point of saying that the wonder of life on Earth is as dramatic and as monumental as a religious belief. And that the wonder of life on Earth is something that we need somehow to communicate better. Is that possible, do you think, when you're so reliant on the empirical here?
I've devoted my life to attempting to communicate that in some 10 books, and I hope to go on doing so. I like to think with some success. I mean, my books have sold in quite large numbers, and I think
yes.
People have told me that they have enjoyed them and have been moved by them. And I mean, on a larger scale, authors like Carl Sagan, both with books and with television productions and things, have done the same. There is enormous satisfaction to be obtained from science, from contemplating the mystery and the wonder of the universe.
And yet you have to understand a certain amount of it. I mean, it's not the same as looking at a wonderful sunset.
That's
right.
But
to look at evolution and its
yes.
in its constituent and complexity, and to understand that is a form of revelation. But very few people are entitled.
You
to
have
it.
To work at it. It's not.
Yeah.
It's.
Well,
it's
most
not,
of us are never
going
to make
trivial.
It.
Yes, I mean it, but it's worth it. It really. I mean, no, it's fun. Sounds like too frivolous a word. It's better than fun.
Yes, I'm talking to Richard Dawkins, the author of his latest book, The Greatest Show on Earth. What exactly is a meme?
Well, that I don't mention memes in this latest book. The meme was the word that I used in my first book, coined in my first book, The Selfish Gene, which is more than 30 years old now. It's a unit of cultural inheritance, so it's analogous to a gene. And there may not be such a thing as an analogy to the gene in human culture, but if there is, then it might be quite an interesting parallel. I was really trying in The Selfish Gene to de-emphasise the gene, because right the way through the rest of the book, the gene had held centre stage as the unit of natural selection. And I wanted to make the point that natural selection, Darwinian natural selection, is potentially a bigger theory than just a genetic theory. It could be that there are other things that are subject to selection, and the main qualification they would have to have is the ability to be accurately copied, accurately replicated. And it's undoubtedly true that there are entities that are accurately copied in human culture, and they're things like words, tunes, clothes fashions, skills, techniques used by carpenters and potters and things that can get passed on from master to apprentice, from teacher to pupil, from parent to child, just simply spread around like an epidemic. And I did adduce religious examples, that religious ideas may behave sort of like viruses. I call them viruses of the mind, spreading from mind to mind, and in some sense taking over like viruses or other parasites do.
So if religion is effectively, religious belief is effectively a meme, then we're in for quite a long spread yet of religion.
Well, not necessarily, because a meme is just something that is spreadable. And so if religious memes can be spread, so can anti-religious memes. It's just a matter of who's the better at spreading them. I've been doing my best to write books and do radio and television programs and things which spread scientific memes. Any idea which has what it takes to be copied, which has what it takes to spread, could be called a meme. I'm not that keen on the language, actually. I mean, others have taken it up rather more than I have. You're the one who brought it up, and I don't want to take responsibility for introducing the meme into this conversation.
All right, enough on the memes. How close is science to actually establishing exactly how evolution began? The
Not
event.
Very close, yes.
And that's the problem, isn't it?
Well, it's a very interesting problem. It may be one that we never solve. It's important not to confuse that with evolution. Evolution is what happened after the origin of life happened, and the origin of life had to be, therefore, the origin of the first gene, the origin of the first self-replicating information, which probably wasn't DNA. Nowadays it is DNA, but it was probably something else. And we genuinely don't know what that event was. It was a very important event, a very singular event. It was very important because it was the start of evolution. You can't have evolution going until there is some self-copying information like a gene. And so it is very important. It's something that chemists are working on. They may never get there. It is possible that the event is so rare in the universe that it's only ever happened on one planet, in which case that one planet, of course, has to be this one. And it's an interesting, rather paradoxical thought that if it's true that life has originated on only one planet, then it would follow that it's such an improbable event, the origin of life is such an improbable event, that we're wasting our time even trying to find a plausible theory of it. And what we should be seeking is actually an implausible theory, because if we had a plausible theory, then the universe would be simply teeming with life. This was a point I made in my lecture in Wellington last night. I personally don't believe that. I mean, I think that it is not all that improbable, which is exactly tantamount to saying that the universe has quite a lot of separate life forms dotted around in islands of life around the galaxies.
And it's just a pity that we're too far away from each other to... perhaps it isn't a pity.
Well, I think it's a pity. I would like to meet some, but it is possible that there are millions of... It could be millions of life forms around the universe, but still so spread out that there's no chance of one ever meeting the other, another.
DNA itself, and the effective discovery of its significance... It clearly changes the nature of the game here. How much has it changed it, and how much is it likely to alter or at least to provide some of the gaps in knowledge that we have already?
Well, changing the game is exactly right. I mean, that's spot on. It began in 1953 when Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA and immediately realized that they had a mechanism for pairing and for self-copying. And it became immediately apparent that the DNA code is a digital code, and so genetics became a branch of information technology. A chromosome, a long length of DNA, is like a computer tape. And that totally revolutionised biology, totally revolutionised our view of life. Darwinism survived. We have a new version of Darwinism. You could call it digital Darwinism. The differential survival of alternative digital coded information. That's what it now is. So that's a rather different way of putting it than Darwin would have put it. Darwin, I think, would have been enthralled by it had he known about it. It certainly vindicates a lot of what Darwin said, which in Darwin's own time started to look a little bit shaky. And DNA, the Watson and Crick molecular revolution, the digital genetics revolution, has to a large extent rehabilitated Darwinism from some of the difficulties that it experienced in Darwin's own time.
What is the RNA theory? Is this just an extension of basic DNA?
Well, RNA is like DNA, and it's a so-called polynucleotide, and it also contains coded information using the same code. RNA acts as a go-between between DNA and other kinds of RNA, and finally between RNA, therefore ultimately DNA, and protein. And protein is the great executive kind of molecule, the molecule that actually makes life happen. So RNA is very vital, is a very vital intermediary between the genetic code and the executive part of the whole process. When you talk about the RNA theory, I think what you mean is the RNA theory of the origin of life, which is the idea that before DNA came on the scene, RNA did some of the job of what is now done by DNA, of keeping the information, and also RNA did some of the job of protein, which is the executive, what I described as the executive branch. It's not as good as DNA at the self-replication, and it's not as good as protein at being an enzyme, being an executive. But it can do both. And so it may be that when life originated, it was RNA that held all the cards, and then in later evolution, DNA took over the self-replicating function, and protein increasingly took over the executive function.
How big a part has plate tectonics played in evolution? And is there more to learn on that front?
Plate tectonics is the modern name for the idea that the map of the world is being redrawn all the time, the continents are drifting about. It began early in the 20th century with the German scientist Alfred Wegener, who called it continental drift. And the idea was then that the continents, like Africa and South America, drifted around. And many people have noticed that the western side of Africa and the eastern side of South America fit rather neatly together. And sure enough, they do. And once upon a time, that's where they were. Once upon a time, Australia and New Zealand were also part of the great southern continent of Gondwana. The modern version of the theory, plate tectonics, doesn't so much talk about the continents drifting as plates moving about. The entire surface of the globe is hard, rocky plates, some of which, much of which, are covered by sea. So whether it's under the sea or not, the whole world is sort of like a fir cone with hard, rocky plates overlapping and moving about. And the continents that we see and the islands that we see are just the bits that rise above the sea. And so Africa, for example, sits on a huge continental plate, and it's just the highlands on the continental plate, and South America sits on another continental plate. Once upon a time, they were all united together: Africa, South America, Antarctica, Australia, New Zealand, Madagascar, and India were all part of the giant southern continent of Gondwana, which fragmented and the parts of it have been drifting apart ever since. It's been said that they drift at the speed with which fingernails grow, which I think is a lovely image.
Yes. It puts it in perspective. It is a very difficult thing for people to grasp the sheer scale of evolution. You were talking...
Yes, and the slowness of it.
Yes. And at the end of this great process stands man, bipedal man, and yet we tend to think of this as the apex.
Yes.
We're wrong, of course.
I think that's wrong. There's not one end. I mean, there are lots and lots of ends. Every living creature, every surviving creature, could be regarded as the temporary end of its own line of evolution. And it may or may not go on to evolve something else. But there's no sense in which we should regard any one of those end points as being the apex. There is no apex. It's a branching tree with millions and millions of branches.
If one assumes that humans will continue to evolve in a physical sense, many of us have back problems because we're not perfect bipedal, are we? And I assume that my descendants won't suffer from back problems. This is a rather prosaic example.
I wouldn't be too optimistic about that. I mean, absolutely right. I think it's true that the reason why so many of us suffer from back pain is that we originally were quadrupedal. We walked on all fours. And then relatively recently, within the last 6 million years, we rose up on our hind legs. And so it sort of works reasonably well, but it's not perfect because unlike a true designer, natural selection has to take what it's given and modify it. There's no possibility of going back to the drawing board and starting afresh, which, of course, is what any engineer would do. Because you can't go back to the drawing board, you are constrained to modify what's already there. And that means that there are inevitable imperfections, which are the legacy of history. And a human back pain is one manifestation of the legacy of history.
Yes, so we're stuck with it for some time.
I think so, and I think it may be optimistic to think that your descendants will get out of it, because it's that all that can be gone, all that can happen, is yet more tinkering.
Yes. Hope springs eternal.
Yes.
If we, by some miracle, were able to rerun what I think you call the tape of evolution, how likely is it that something like us would emerge again?
This thought experiment was first suggested by the American biologist Stuart Kaufman, and he was imagining rerunning the tape millions of times and counting up the number of times it would end up with this outcome or that outcome. It's a very interesting question whether you would get certain predictable outcomes. Many of my colleagues think you wouldn't get anything the same. I think you probably would. I'm not sure whether you'd actually get humans, but I think you'd get a lot of similarity. And the reason I say that is that it's kind of been done in a small way in places like Australia and South America, which, after the breakup of Gondwana that we were talking about earlier, began mammal evolution in their own separate ways. And so in Australia, we had nothing but marsupials. In South America, there were marsupials and eutherian mammals, but they were very unique. I mean, and South America took its own evolutionary course, which was different from Australia and different from the old world. And yet there are clear similarities. So in South America, for example, there were marsupial saber-toothed tigers, which were similar to the true cat saber-toothed tigers, and these great big, huge, long, stabbing canine teeth, which doubtless did the same job of stabbing into prey. And in Australia, you have marsupial moles, marsupial mice, marsupial flying squirrels, marsupial cats, marsupial rabbits, and so on. In New Zealand, with a total dearth of mammals, birds, having flown there, having got there by their power of their wings, then, as it were, turned into mammals. Not, of course, they didn't really turn into mammals, but they filled the mammal role. Many of them became flightless. Many of them started doing the kind... Kiwis, for example, did the kind of things that mammals do. So you've got this rerun of experiments, of the natural experiment of rerunning evolution, not going right back to the origin of life, as Kaufman was talking about, but going back at least to the origin of the mammals. And there does seem to be a certain predictability about it.
And that was Richard Dawkins. And the book, The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution, is published by Bantam Press.